Geryon looked more carefully at the Murgo, and realized that it was true.
"Hail, Eternal Salmisra," the Grolem said perfunctorily, bowing first to the queen and then to the statue behind her. "Tower Urgas, king of Ktalmurgos, sends greetings to the spirit of Itha and his handmaiden."
"And are there no greetings from Tuchek, high priest of the Grolems?"
she asked, her eyes bright.
"Of course," the Grolem said, "but those are customarily given in private."
"Is your errand here on behalf of Tar Ogos or of Tuchek?"
she inquired, turning to examine her reflection in the mirror.
"May we speak in private, Your Majesty?" the Grolem asked.
"We are in private."
"But..."
he looked around at the kneeling eunuchs in the room.
"My body servants, an Hissan queen is never left alone. You should know that by now."
"And that one?"
the Grolem pointed at Geryon.
"He is also a servant, but of a slightly different kind."
The Grolem shrugged.
"Whatever you wish. I salute you in the name of Tuchek, high priest of the Grolems and disciple of Tarak."
"The handmaiden of Issa salutes Tuchek of Raktul,"
she responded formally.
"What does the Grolem high priest want of me?"
"The boy, Your Majesty."
"Which boy is that?"
"The boy you stole from Palgra, who now sits at your feet."
She laughed scornfully.
"Convey my regrets to Tuchek, but that would be impossible."
"It is unwise to deny the wishes of Tuchek," the Grolem warned.
"It's even more unwise to make demands of Salmisra in her own palace. What is Tuchek prepared to offer for this boy?"
"His eternal friendship."
"What need has this serpent queen of friends?"
"Gold, then,"
the Grolem offered with annoyance.
"I know the secret of the red gold of Angarak. I do not wish to become a slave to it. Keep your gold, Grolem."
"Might I say that the game you play is very dangerous, Your Majesty? You have already made Balgara your enemy. Can you afford the enmity of Tuchek as well?"
"I am not afraid of Balgara, nor of Tuchek,"
she answered him.
"The queen's bravery is remarkable."
"This is beginning to get tiresome. My terms are very simple. Tell Tuchek that I have Torak's enemy, and I will keep him, unless..."
She paused.
"Unless what, Your Highness?"
"If Tuchek will speak to Torak for me, an agreement might be reached."
"What sort of agreement?"
"I will give the boy to Torak as a wedding gift."
The Grolem blinked.
"If Torak will make me his bride and give me immortality, I will deliver Belgarion up to him."
"All the world knows that the dragon god of Angarak is bound in slumber,"
the Grolem objected.
"But he will not sleep forever,"
Salmisra said flatly.
"The priests of Angarak and the sorcerers of Aloria always seem to forget that eternal Salmisra can read the signs in the heavens as clearly as they. The day of Tarak's awakening is at hand. Tell Tuchek that upon the day that I am wed to Tarak, Belgarion will be in his hands. Until that day, the boy is mine."
"I shall deliver your message to Tuchek,"
the Grolem said with a stiff, icy bow.
"Leave, then,"
she told him with an airy wave of her hand.
"So, that's it,"
the voice in Geryon's mind said, as the Grolem left.
I should have known, I suppose.
Maas the serpent suddenly raised his head, his great neck flaring and his eyes burning.
Beware,
he hissed.
Of the Grolem?
Salmisra laughed.
I have nothing to fear from him.
Not from the Grolem. Fat one.
Maas flickered his tongue at Geryon.
Its mind is awake.
That's impossible,
she objected.
Nevertheless, its mind is awake. It has to do, I think, with that metal thing around its neck.
Remove the ornament, then,
she told the snake. Maas lowered his length to the floor and slid around the divan toward Geryon.
Remain very still,
Geryon's inner voice told him.
Don't try to fight.
Numbly, Geryon watched the blunt head draw closer. The snake raised its head, his hood flaring, his nervous tongue darting. Slowly he leaned forward. His nose touched the silver amulet hanging about Geryon's neck. There was a bright blue spark as the reptile's head came in contact with the amulet. Geryon felt the familiar surge, but tightly controlled now, focused down to a single point. Maas recoiled, and the spark from the amulet leaped out, sizzling through the air, linking the silver disc to the reptile's nose. The snake's eyes began to shrivel, and steam poured from his nostrils and his gaping mouth. Then the spark was gone, and the body of the dead snake writhed and twisted convulsively on the polished stone floor of the chamber.
Maas!
Salmisra shrieked. The eunuchs scrambled out of the way of the wildly threshing body of the snake.
My queen,
a shave-headed functionary gibbered from the door.
The world is sending.
What?
Salmisra tore her eyes from the convulsions of the snake.
The sun has gone out. Moon is as dark as midnight. The city has gone mad with terror.
Chapter 29. In the tumult which followed that announcement, Geryon sat quietly on the cushions beside Salmisra's throne. The quiet voice in his mind, however, was speaking to him rapidly.
Stay very still. Don't say anything, and don't do anything. Get my astronomers here immediately,
Salmisra ordered.
I want to know why I wasn't warned about this eclipse.
It's not an eclipse, my queen,
the bald functionary wailed, groveling on the polished floor not far from the still writhing Maas.
The dark, it came like a great curtain. It was a moving wall. No wind, no rain, no thunder. It swallowed the sun without a sound.
He began to sob brokenly.
We shall never see the sun again.
Stop that, you idiot,
Salmisra snapped.
Get on your feet. Tzadi, take this babbling fool out of here and go look at the sky. Then come back to me here. I have to know what's going on.
Tzadi shook himself almost like a dog coming out of the water and pulled his fascinated eyes off of the dead fixed grin on the face of Maas. He pulled the blubbering functionary to his feet and led him out of the chamber. Salmisra turned then on Geryon.
How did you do that?
She demanded, pointing at the twitching form of Maas.
I don't know,
he said. His mind was still sunk in a fog. Only the quiet corner where the voice lived was alert.
Take off the amulet,
she commanded. Obediently, Geryon reached his hands toward the medallion. Suddenly, his hands froze. They would not move. He let them fall.
I can't.
Take it from him,
she ordered one of the eunuchs. The man glanced once at the dead snake, then stared at Geryon. He shook his head and backed away in fright.
Do as I say,
the Snake Queen ordered sharply. From somewhere in the palace came a hollow, reverberating crash. There was the sound of nails screeching out of heavy wood, and the avalanche noise of a wall collapsing. Then, a long way down one of the dim corridors, someone screamed in agony. The dry consciousness in his mind reached out, probing. "At last," it said with obvious relief.
"What's going on out there?"
Samisra blazed.
"Come with me,"
the voice in Garion's mind said.
"I need your help."
Garion put his hands under him and started to push himself up.
"No, this way."
A strange image of separation rose in Garion's mind. Unthinking, he willed the separation and felt himself rising and yet not moving. Suddenly, he had no sense of his body, no arms or legs, yet he seemed to move. He saw himself, his own body, sitting stupidly on the cushions at Salmisra's feet.
"Hurry,"
the voice said to him. It was no longer inside his mind, but seemed to be somewhere beside him. A dim shape was there, formless, but somehow very familiar. The fog that had clouded Garion's wits was gone, and he felt very alert.
"Who are you?"
he demanded of the shape beside him.
"There isn't time to explain. Quickly, we have to lead them back before Salmisra has time to do anything."
"Lead who?"
"Palgara
and Beric."
"Aunt Paul? Where is she?"
"Come," the voice said urgently.
Together, Garion and the strange presence at his side seemed to waft toward the closed door. They passed through it as if it were no more than insubstantial mist, and emerged in the corridor outside. Then they were flying, soaring down the corridor with no sense of air rushing past or even of movement. A moment later they came out into that vast open hall where Essus had first brought Garion when they entered the palace. There they stopped, hovering in the air. Aunt Paul, her splendid eyes ablaze and a fiery nimbus about her, strode through the hall. Beside her hulked the great shaggy bear Garion had seen before. Barak's face seemed vaguely within that bestial head, but there was no humanity in it. The beast's eyes were afire with raging madness, and its mouth gaped horribly. Desperate guards tried to push the bear back with long pikes, but the beast swiped the pikes away and fell upon the guards. Its vast embrace crushed them, and its flailing claws ripped them open. The trail behind Aunt Paul and the bear was littered with maimed bodies and quivering chunks of flesh. The snakes which had lain in the corners were seething across the floor, but as they came into contact with the flaming light which surrounded Aunt Paul, they died, even as Ma'as had died. Methodically, Aunt Paul was blasting down doors with word and gesture. A thick wall barred her way, and she brushed it into rubble, as if it had been made of cobwebs. Barak raged through the dim hall, roaring insanely, destroying everything in his path. A shrieking eunuch tried desperately to climb one of the pillars. The great beast reared up and hooked his claws into the man's back and pulled him down. The shrieks ended abruptly in a spurt of brains and blood when the massive jaws closed with a sickening crunch on the eunuch's head.
"Palgara!"
the presence beside Garion shouted soundlessly.
"This way!"
Aunt Paul turned quickly.
"Follow us,"
the presence said.
"Hurry!"
Then Garion and that other part of himself were flying back down the corridor toward Salmisra and the semi-conscious body they had recently vacated. Behind them came Aunt Paul and the ravening Barak. Garion and his strange companion passed again through the heavy closed door. Salmisra, her naked body mottled now with rage rather than lust beneath her transparent gown, stood over the vacant-eyed form on the cushions.
"Answer me,"
she was shouting.
"Answer me."
"When we get back," the shapeless presence said, "let me handle things. We have to buy some time."
And then they were back. Garion felt his body shudder briefly, and he was looking out through his own eyes again.
The fog, which had benumbed him before, came rushing back.
What?
His lips said, though he had not consciously formed the word.
I said, this is your doing.
Is what my doing? The voice coming from his lips sounded like his, but there was a subtle difference.
All of it. The darkness. The attack on my palace.
I don't think so. How could I? I'm only a boy.
Don't lie to me, Belgarion. I know who you are. I know what you are. It has to be you. Belgarath himself could not blot out the sun. I warn you, Belgarion. What you have drunk today is death. Even now the poison in your veins is killing you.
Why did you do that to me?
To keep you. You must have more, or you will die. You must drink what only I can give you, and you must drink every day of your life. You are mine, Belgarion, mine!
Despairing shrieks came from just outside the door. The Serpent Queen looked up, startled, then she turned to the huge statue behind her, bowed down in a strange ceremonial way, and began to weave her hands through the air in a series of intricate gestures. She started to pronounce an involved formula in a language Garion had never heard before, a language filled with guttural hissings and strange cadences. The heavy door exploded inward, blasted into splinters, and Aunt Paul stood in the shattered doorway, her white lock ablaze and her eyes dreadful. The great bear at her side roared, his teeth dripping blood and with tatters of flesh still hanging from his claws.
I have warned you, Salmisra,
Aunt Paul spoke in a deadly voice.
Stop where you are, Bulgara,
the queen ordered. She did not turn around, and her fingers continued their sinuous weaving in the air.
The boy is dying. Nothing can save him if you attack me.
Aunt Paul stopped.
What have you done? Look at him,
Salmisra said.
He has drunk Athal and Galdis. Even now there are fires in his veins. He will need more very soon.
Her hands still moved in the air, and her face was fixed in extreme concentration. Her lips began moving again in that guttural hissing.
Is it true?
Aunt Paul's voice echoed in Garion's mind.
It seems to be, the dry voice replied. They made him drink things, and he seems different now.
Aunt Paul's eyes widened.
Who are you? I've always been here, Palgara. Didn't you know that?
Did Garion know?
He knows that I'm here. He doesn't know what it means.
We can talk about that later,
she decided.
Watch very closely. This is what you have to do.
A confused blur of images welled up in Garion's mind.
Do you understand?
Of course.
I'll show him how.
Can't you do it?
No, Palgara. The power is his,
the dry voice said.
Not mine. Don't worry. He and I understand each other.
Garion felt strangely alone as the two voices spoke together in his mind.
Garion,
the dry voice spoke quietly,
I want you to think about your blood.
My blood?
Mm-hmm. We're going to change it for a moment.
Why?
To burn away the poison they gave you. Now concentrate on your blood.
Garion did.
You want it to be like this.
An image of yellow came into Garion's mind.
Do you understand?
Yes.
Do it then. Now.
Garion put his fingertips to his chest and willed his blood to change. He suddenly felt as if he were on fire. His heart began to pound, and a heavy sweat burst out all over his body.
A moment longer,
the voice said.
Geryon was dying. His altered blood seared through his veins, and he began to tremble violently. His heart hammered in his chest like a tripping sledge. His eyes went dark, and he began to topple slowly forward. "Now," the voice demanded sharply, "change it back." Then it was over. Geryon's heart stuttered and then faltered back to its normal pace. He was exhausted, but the fog in his brain was gone. "It's done, Palgara," the other Geryon said. "You can do what needs doing now." Aunt Paul had watched anxiously, but now her face became dreadfully stern. She walked across the polished floor toward the dais. "Sal Misra, turn and look at me." The queen's hands were raised above her head now, and the hissing words tumbled from her lips, rising finally to a hoarse shout. Then, far above them, in the shadows near the ceiling, the eyes of the huge statue opened and began to glow a deep emerald fire. A polished jewel on Salmisra's crown began also to burn with the same glow. The statue moved. The sound it made was a kind of ponderous creaking, deafeningly loud. The solid rock from which the huge shape had been hewn bent and flexed as the statue took a step forward and then another.
"Why did you summon me?"
an enormous voice demanded through stiff, stony lips. The voice reverberated hollowly up from the massive chest.
"Defend thine hand, maiden great Issa,"
Salmisra cried, turning to look triumphantly at Aunt Paul.
"This evil sorceress has invaded thy domain to slay me. Her wicked power is so great that none may withstand her. I am thy promised bride, and I place myself under thy protection."
"Who is this who defiles my temple?"
the statue demanded in a vast roar.
"Who dares to raise her hand against my chosen and beloved?"
The emerald eyes flashed in dreadful wrath. Aunt Paul stood alone in the center of the polished floor, with the vast statue looming above her. Her face was unafraid.
"You go too far, Salmisra. This is forbidden."
The Serpent Queen laughed scornfully.
"Forbidden? What does your forbidding mean to me? Flee now, or face the wrath of divine Issa. Contend, if you will, with a god."
"If I must," Aunt Paul said. She straightened then and spoke in a single word. The roaring in Geryon's mind at that word was overwhelming. Then, suddenly, she began to grow. Foot by foot, she towered up, rising like a tree, expanding, growing gigantic before Geryon's stunned eyes. Within a moment, she faced the great stone god as an equal.
"Palgara,"
the god's voice sounded puzzled.
"Why have you done this?"
"I come in fulfillment of the prophecy, Lord Issa," she said. "Thy handmaiden hath betrayed thee and thy brothers."
"It cannot be so. She is my chosen one. Her face is the face of my beloved."
"The face is the same," Aunt Paul said. "But this is not the Salmisra, beloved of Issa. A 100 Salmisras have served thee in this temple since thy beloved died."
"Died?" the god said incredulously.
"She lies,"
Salmisra shrieked.
"I am thy beloved, O my lord. Let not her lies turn thee from me. Kill her."
"The prophecy approaches its day," Aunt Paul said. "The boy, at Salmisra's feet, is its fruit. He must be returned to me, or the prophecy will fail."
"Is the day of the prophecy come so soon?"
the god asked.
It is not soon, Lord Issa. It is late. Thy slumber hath encompassed eons.
Lies! All lies!
Salmisra cried desperately, clinging to the ankle of the huge stone god.
I must test the truth of this, the god said slowly. I have slept long and deeply, and now the world comes upon me unaware.
Destroy her, O my lord,
Salmisra demanded.
Her lies are an abomination, a desecration of thy holy presence.
I will find the truth, Salmisra,
Issa said. Geryon felt a brief, enormous touch upon his mind. Something had brushed him, something so vast that his imagination shuddered back from its immensity. Then the touch moved on.
Ah!
The sigh came from the floor. The dead snake Maas stirred.
Ah! Let me sleep,
it hissed.
In but a moment, Issa said. What was your name?
I was called Maas. I was counselor and companion to eternal Salmisra. Send me back, Lord. I cannot bear to live again.
Is this my beloved Salmisra?
Her successor,
Maas sighed.
Thy beloved priestess died thousands of years ago. Each new Salmisra is chosen because of her resemblance to thy beloved.
Ah,
Issa said with pain in his huge voice.
And what was this woman's purpose in removing Belgarion from Polgara's care?
She sought alliance with Torak. She thought to trade Belgarion to the Accursed One in exchange for the immortality his embrace would bestow upon her.
His embrace? My priestess would submit to the foul embrace of my mad brother?
Willingly, Lord, Maas said. It is her nature to seek the embrace of any man or god or beast who passes.
A look of repugnance flickered across Issa's stony face.
Has it always been so?
Always, Lord. The potion which maintains her youth and semblance to thy beloved sets her veins afire with lust. That fire remains unquenched until she dies. Let me go, Lord. The pain.
Sleep, Maas,
Issa granted sorrowfully.
Take my thanks with you down into silent death.
Maas sighed and sank down again.
I, too, will return to slumber. I must not remain, lest my presence rouse Torak to that war which would unmake the world.
The great statue stepped back to the spot where it had stood for thousands of years. The deafening creak and groan of flexing rock again filled the huge chamber.
"Deal with this woman as it pleases thee, Polgara," the stone god said. "Only spare her life out of remembrance of my beloved."
"I will, Lord Issa,"
Aunt Paul said, bowing to the statue.
"And carry my love to my brother Aldur,"
the hollow voice said, fading away, even as it spoke.
"Sleep, Lord,"
Aunt Paul said.
"May thy slumber wash away thy grief."
"No,"
Salmisra wailed, but the green fire had already died in the statue's eyes, and the jewel on her crown flickered, then went dark.
"It is time, Salmisra,"
Aunt Paul, vast and terrible, announced.
"Don't kill me, Palgara,"
the queen begged, falling to her knees.
"Please, don't kill me."
"I am not going to kill you, Salmisra," Aunt Paul told her.
"I promised Lord Issa that I would spare your life."
"I didn't make any such promise,"
Barak said from the doorway. Geryon looked sharply at his huge friend, dwarfed now by Aunt Paul's immensity. The bear was gone, and in its place the big Kerak stood, sword in hand.
"No, Barak. I'm going to solve the problem of Salmisra once and for all."
Aunt Paul turned back to the groveling queen.
"You will live, Salmisra. You will live for a very long time. Eternally, perhaps."
An impossible hope dawned in Salmisra's eyes. Slowly, she rose to her feet and looked up at the huge figure rising above her.
"Eternally, Palgara?" "But I must change you," Aunt Paul answered. "The poison you have drunk to keep you young and beautiful is slowly killing you. Even now its traces are beginning to show on your face."
The queen's hands flew to her cheeks, and she turned quickly to look into her mirror.
"You are decaying, Salmisra. Soon you will be ugly and old. The lust which fills you will burn itself out, and you will die. Your blood is too warm. That's the whole problem."
"But how?"
Salmisra faltered.
"A little change," Aunt Paul assured her. "Just a small one. And you will live forever."
Geryon could feel the force of her will gathering itself.
"I will make you eternal, Salmisra."
She raised her hand and spoke a single word. The terrible force of the word shook Geryon like a leaf in the wind. At first, nothing seemed to happen. Salmisra stood fixed with her pale nakedness gleaming through her gown. Then, the strange mottling grew more pronounced, and her thighs pressed tightly together. Her face began to shift, to grow more pointed. Her lips disappeared as her mouth spread, and its corners slid up into a fixed reptilian grin. Geryon watched in horror, unable to take his eyes off of the queen. Her gown slid away as her shoulders disappeared, and her arms adhered to her sides. Her body began to elongate, and her legs, grown completely together now, began to loop into coils. Her lustrous hair disappeared, and the last vestiges of humanity faded from her face. Her golden crown, however, remained firmly upon her head. Her tongue flickered as she sank down into the mass of her loops and coils. The hood upon her neck spread as she looked with flat, dead eyes at Aunt Paul, who had somehow, during the queen's transformation, resumed her normal size.
"Ascend your throne, Salmisra," Aunt Paul said.
The queen's head remained immobile, but her coils looped and mounted the cushioned divan, and the sounds of coil against coil was a dry, dusty rasp. Aunt Paul turned to Sadi, the eunuch.
"Behold,
the handmaiden of Issa, the queen of the snake people, whose dominion shall endure until the end of days. For she is immortal now, and will reign in Nyssa forever.
Sadi's face was ghastly pale, and his eyes bulged wildly. He swallowed hard and nodded.
I'll leave you with your queen, then. I'd prefer to go peacefully, but one way or another, the boy and I are leaving.
I'll send word ahead, Sadi agreed quickly. No one will try to bar your way.
Wise decision, Barak said dryly.
All hail the Serpent Queen of Nitha,
one of the crimson-robed eunuchs pronounced in a shaking voice, sinking to his knees before the dais.
Praise her,
the others responded ritualistically, also kneeling.
Her glory is revealed to us. Worship her.
Yarian glanced back once as he followed Aunt Paul toward the shattered door. Salmisra lay upon her throne, with her mottled coils redundantly piled, and her hooded head turned toward the mirror. The golden crown sat atop her head, and her flat, serpent eyes regarded her reflection in the glass. There was no expression on her reptile face, so it was impossible to know what she was thinking. Chapter 30 The corridors and vaulted halls of the palace were empty, as Aunt Paul led them from the throne room where the eunuchs knelt, chanting their praises to the Serpent Queen. Sword in hand, Barak stalked grimly through the awful carnage that marked the trail he had left when he had entered. The big man's face was pale, and he frequently averted his eyes from some of the more savagely mutilated corpses that littered their way. When they emerged, they found the streets of Stithistor darker than night, and filled with hysterical crowds wailing in terror. Barak, with a torch he had taken from the palace wall in one hand and his huge sword in the other, led them into the street. Even in their panic, the Nyssans made way for him.
"What is this, Balgora?"
he growled over his shoulder, waving the torch slightly as if to brush the darkness away.
"Is it some kind of sorcery?"
No, it is not sorcery.
Tiny flecks of gray were falling through the torchlight.
Snow?
Barak asked incredulously.
No. Ashes.
What is burning?
A mountain. Let's go back to the ship as quickly as we can. There is more danger from this crowd than from any of this.
She threw her light cloak about Geryon's shoulders and pointed down a street where a few torches bobbed here and there.
Let's go that way.
The ash began to fall more heavily. It was almost like dirty gray flour, sifting down through the sodden air, and there was a dreadful sulfurous stink to it. By the time they reached the wharves, the absolute darkness had begun to pale. The ash continued to drift down, seeping into the cracks between the cobblestones, and gathering in little windrows along the edges of the buildings. Though it was growing lighter, the falling ash, like fog, blotted out everything more than 10 feet away. The wharves were in total chaos. Crowds of Nyssans, shrieking and wailing, were trying to climb into boats to flee from the choking ash that sifted with deadly silence down through the damp air. Mad with terror, many even leaped into the deadly water of the river.
"We're not going to be able to get through that mob, Balgora. Stay here a moment."
He sheathed his sword, jumped up, and caught the edge of a low roof. He pulled himself up and stood outlined dimly above them.
"Oh, Graldek!"
he roared in a huge voice that carried even over the noise of the crowd.
"Barak?"
Graldek's voice came back.
"Where are you?" "At the foot of the pier,"
Barak shouted.
"We can't get through the crowd." "Stay there," Graldek yelled back. "We'll come and get you."
After a few moments, there was the tramp of heavy feet on the wharf, and the occasional sound of blows. A few cries of pain mingled with the sounds of panic from the crowd. Then Graldek, Manurallan, and a half-dozen burly sailors armed with clubs strode out of the ashfall, clearing a path with brutal efficiency. Did you get lost? Greldik yelled up to Barak. Barak jumped down from the roof.
We had to stop by the palace,
he answered shortly.
We were growing concerned for thy safety, m'lady,
Mandarallan told Aunt Paul, pushing a gibbering Niacin out of his way.
Gudernik returned some hours ago.
We were delayed. Captain, can you get us on board your ship?
Greldik gave her an evil grin.
Let's go, then. As soon as we get on board, it might be a good idea to anchor out in the river a little way. This ash will settle after a while, but these people are going to be hysterical until it's done. Has there been any word from Silk or my father yet?
Nothing, my lady, Greldik said.
What is he doing?
She demanded irritably of no one in particular. Mandarallan drew his broadsword and marched directly into the face of the crowd, neither slowing nor altering his course. The Nissans melted out of his path. The crowd, pressing at the edge of the wharf beside Greldik's ship, was even thicker, and Dernik, Hetar, and the rest of the sailors lined the rail with long boat hooks, pushing the terror-stricken people away.
"Run out the plank!" Greldik shouted as they reached the edge of the wharf.
"Noble captain,"
a bald Nissan blubbered, clinging to Greldik's fur vest.
"I'll give you 100 gold pieces if you let me aboard your ship."
Disgusted, Greldik pushed him away.
1,000 gold pieces,
the Nissan promised, clutching Greldik's arm and waving a purse.
Get this baboon off of me, Greldik ordered.
One of the sailors rather casually clubbed the Nissan into insensibility, then bent and yanked the purse from his grip. He opened the purse and poured the coins out into one hand.
3 pieces of silver, he said with disgust. Oh, the rest is copper.
He turned back and kicked the unconscious man in the stomach. They crossed to the ship, one by one, while Barak and Mandarallan held the crowd back with the threat of massive violence.
Cut the hawsers, Greldik shouted to his men when they were all aboard.
The sailors chopped the thick hawsers loose to a great cry of dismay from the Nissans crowding the edge of the wharf. The sluggish current pulled the ship slowly away, and wails and despairing moans followed them as they drifted.
Geryon, Aunt Paul said, why don't you go below and put on some decent clothes and wash that disgusting rouge off your face? Then come back up here. I want to talk to you.
Geryon had forgotten how scantily he was dressed, and he flushed slightly and went quickly below decks. It had grown noticeably lighter when he came back up, dressed again in tunic and hose, but the gray ash still sifted down through the motionless air, making the world around them hazy and coating everything with a heavy layer of fine grit. They had drifted some distance out into the river, and Greldik's sailors had dropped the anchor. The ship swung slowly in the sluggish current.
"Over here, Geryon,"
Aunt Paul called. She was standing near the prow, looking out into the dusty haze. Geryon went to her a little hesitantly, the memory of what had happened at the palace still strong in his mind.
"Sit down, dear. There's something I have to talk to you about."
"Yes, ma'am,"
he said, sitting on the bench.
"Geryon,"
she turned to look at him,
"did anything happen while you were in Salmisra's palace?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean," she said rather crisply. "You are not going to embarrass us both by making me ask certain questions, are you?"
"Oh,"
Geryon blushed.
"That, no, nothing like that happened."
He remembered the lush over-ripeness of the queen with a certain regret.
"Good. That was the one thing I was afraid of. You cannot afford to get involved in any of that sort of thing just yet. It has some peculiar effects on one in your rather special circumstances."
"I'm not sure that I understand."
"You have certain abilities," she told him. "And if you start experimenting with that other thing before they are fully matured, the results can sometimes be a bit unpredictable. It is better not to confuse things at this point."
Maybe it would be better if something had happened then?
Geryon blurted.
Maybe it would have fixed it so I couldn't hurt people anymore. I doubt it. Your power's too great to be neutralized so easily. Do you remember what we talked about that day when we left Tulnedra? About instruction? I don't need any instruction, he protested, his tone growing sullen. Yes, you do. And you need it now. Your power is enormous. More power than I've ever seen before, and some of it so complex that I cannot even begin to understand it. You must begin your instruction before something disastrous happens. You are totally out of control, Geryon. If you are really serious about not wanting to hurt people, you should be more than willing to start learning how to keep any accidents from happening. I don't want to be a sorcerer. All I want to do is to get rid of it. Can't you help me do that?
She shook her head.
No. And I wouldn't, even if I could. You cannot renounce it, my Geryon. It is part of you.
Then I'm going to be a monster?
Geryon demanded bitterly.
I'm going to go around burning people alive or turning them into toads or snakes? And maybe after a while I'll get so used to it that it won't even bother me anymore. I'll live forever like you and Grandfather. But I won't be human anymore. Aunt Paul, I think I'd rather be dead.
Can't you reason with him?
Her voice inside his head spoke directly to that other awareness.
Not at the moment, Balgra,
the dry voice replied. He's too busy wallowing in self-pity.
He must learn to control the power he has.
I'll keep him out of mischief, the voice promised.
I don't think there's much else we can do until Belgarath gets back. He's going through a moral crisis, and we cannot really tamper with him until he works out his own solutions to it. I don't like to see him suffering this way.
You are too tender-hearted, Palgara.
He's a sturdy boy, and a bit of suffering won't damage him. Will the two of you stop treating me as if I'm not even here?
Geryon demanded angrily. Mistress Paul, Durnick said, coming across the deck to them. I think you had better come quickly. Barak's going to kill himself.
He's what?
It's something about a curse, Durnick explained. He says he's going to fall on his own sword.
That idiot. Where is he?
He's back by the stern. Got his sword out and he won't let anybody near him.
Come with me.
She started toward the stern with Geryon and Durnick behind her.
We have all experienced better madness, my lord, Mander Allen was saying, trying to reason with the big Jerek. It is not a thing of which to be proud, but neither is it a cause for such bleak despair.
Barak did not answer, but stood at the very stern of the ship, his eyes blank with horror, and his huge sword weaving in a slow, menacing arc, holding everyone at bay. Aunt Paul walked through the crowd of sailors and directly up to him.
Don't try to stop me, Palgra.
She reached out quite calmly and touched the point of his sword with one finger.
It is a little dull, she said thoughtfully. Why don't we have Durnick sharpen it? That way it will slip more smoothly between your ribs when you fall on it.
Barak looked a bit startled.
Have you made all of the necessary arrangements?
What arrangements?
For the disposal of your body. Really, Barak, I thought you had better manners. A decent man does not burden his friends with that kind of chore.
She thought a moment.
Burning is customary, I suppose. But the wood here in Nyssa is very soggy. You'd probably smolder for a week or more. I imagine we'll have to settle for just dumping you in the river. The leeches and crayfish should have you stripped to the bone in a day or so.
Barak's expression grew hurt.
Did you want us to take your sword and shield back to your son?
I don't have a son,
he answered sullenly. He was obviously not prepared for her brutal practicality.
Oh, didn't I tell you? How forgetful of me.
What are you talking about?
Oh, never mind. It's not important now. Were you just going to fall on your sword, or would you prefer to run up against the mast with the hilt? Either way works rather well.
She turned to the sailors.
Would you clear a path so the Earl of Trelheim can get a good run at the mast?
The sailors stared at her.
What did you mean about a sun?
Barak asked, lowering his sword.
It would only unsettle your mind, Barak. You'd probably make a mess of killing yourself if I told you about it. We'd really rather not have you lying around groaning for weeks on end. That sort of thing is so depressing, you know.
I want to know what you are talking about.
Oh, very well, she said with a great sigh. Your wife Meryl is with child. The result of certain courtesies you exchanged when we visited Val Alorn, I imagine. She looks like a rising moon at the moment, and your lusty brat is making her life miserable with his kicking.
A son?
Barak said, his eyes suddenly very wide.
Really, Barak, you must learn to pay attention. You'll never make anything of yourself if you keep blundering around with your ears closed like this.
A son?
He repeated, his sword sliding out of his fingers.
Oh, now you've dropped it, she chided him. Pick it up immediately. Let's get on with this. It is very inconsiderate to take all day to kill yourself like this.
I'm not going to kill myself,
he told her indignantly.
You're not?
Of course not,
he sputtered. And then he saw the faint flicker of a smile playing about the corners of her mouth. He hung his head sheepishly.
You great fool, she said.
Then she took hold of his beard with both hands, pulled his head down, and kissed his ash-dusted face soundly.
Greldik began to chortle, and Mandarallan stepped forward and caught Barak in a rough embrace.
I rejoice with thee, my friend. My heart soars for thee.
Bring up a cask, Greldik told the sailors, pounding on his friend's back. We'll salute Trelheim's heir with the bright brown ale of timeless Cherek.
I expect this will get rowdy now, Aunt Paul said quietly to Geryon. Come with me.
She led the way back toward the ship's prow.
Will she ever change back?
Geryon asked when they were alone again.
What? The queen. Will she ever change back again? In time, she won't even want to. The shapes we assume begin to dominate our thinking after a while. As the years go by, she'll become more and more a snake and less a woman.
Geryon shuddered.
It would have been kinder to have killed her. I promised Lord Issa that I would not. Was that really the god? His spirit,
she replied, looking out into the hazy ashfall.
Salmisra infused the statue with his spirit. For a time, at least, the statue was the god. Oh, it's all very complicated.
She seemed a bit preoccupied.
Where is he?
She seemed suddenly irritated.
Who? Father, he should have been here days ago.
They stood together looking out at the muddy river. Finally, she turned from the railing and brushed at the shoulders of her cloak with distaste. The ash puffed from under her fingers in tiny clouds.
I'm going below, she told him, making a face. It is just too dirty up here. I thought you wanted to talk to me. I don't think you're ready to listen. It will wait.
She stepped away and then stopped.
Oh, Geryon. Yes? I would not drink any of that ale the sailors are swilling. After what they made you drink at the palace, it would probably make you sick.
Oh, he agreed, a trifle regretfully.
All right. It is up to you, of course. But I thought you ought to know.
Then she turned again and went to the hatch and disappeared down the stairs.
Geryon's emotions were turbulent. The entire day had been vastly eventful, and his mind was filled with a welter of confusing images.
Be quiet,
the voice in his mind said.
What?
I'm trying to hear something. Listen.
Listen to what?
There. Can't you hear it?
Faintly, as if from a very long way off, Geryon seemed to hear a muffled thudding.
What is it?
The voice did not answer, but the amulet about his neck began to throb in time with the distant thudding. Behind him he heard a rush of tiny feet.
Geryon!
He turned, just in time to be caught in Sinedra's embrace.
I was so worried about you. Where did you go?
Some men came on board and grabbed me, he said, trying to untangle himself from her arms.
They took me to the palace. Oh, how awful! Did you meet the queen?
Geryon nodded, and then shuddered, remembering the hooded snake lying on the divan looking at itself in the mirror.
What is wrong?
The girl asked.
A lot of things happened. Some of them weren't very pleasant.
Somewhere at the back of his awareness, the thudding continued.
Do you mean they tortured you?
Sinedra asked, her eyes growing very wide.
No, nothing like that. Well, what happened? Tell me.
He knew that she would not leave him alone until he did, so he described what had happened as best as he could. The throbbing sound seemed to grow louder while he talked, and his right palm began to tingle. He rubbed at it absently.
Oh, absolutely dreadful,
Sinedra said, after he had finished.
Weren't you terrified?
Not really, he told her, still scratching at his palm.
Most of the time the things they made me drink made my head so foggy I couldn't feel anything. Did you really kill Maas? Just like that?
She snapped her tiny fingers.
Well, it wasn't exactly just like that, he tried to explain. There was a little more to it. I knew you were a sorcerer. I told you that you were that day at the pool, you remember? I don't want to be. I didn't ask to be. I did not ask to be a princess either. But that's not the same thing. Being a king or a princess is what one is. Being a sorcerer has to do with what one does. I really don't see that much difference,
she objected stubbornly.
I can make things happen. Awful things, usually. Well, so?
She said maddeningly.
I can make awful things happen, too. Or at least I could back in Tol Hanath. One word from me could have sent a servant to the whipping post, or to the headsman's block. I didn't do it, of course, but I could have. Power is power, Geryon. The results are the same. You don't have to hurt people if you don't want to. It just happens sometimes. It's not that I want to do it.
The throbbing had become a nagging thing, almost like a dull headache.
But then you have to learn to control it. And now you sound like Aunt Paul. She is trying to help you. She keeps trying to get you to do what you're going to have to do eventually anyway. How many more people are you going to have to burn up before you finally accept what she says?
You didn't have to say that. Geryon was stung deeply by her words.
Yes, she told him. I think I did. You're lucky I'm not your aunt. I wouldn't put up with your foolishness the way Lady Palgara does.
But you don't understand, Geryon muttered sullenly.
I understand much better than you think, Geryon. You know what your problem is? You don't want to grow up. You want to keep on being a boy forever. You can't, though. Nobody can. No matter how much power you have. Whether you are an emperor or a sorcerer, you cannot stop the years from going by. I realized that a long time ago. But then I'm probably much smarter than you are.
Then, without any word of explanation, she raised up on her toes and kissed him lightly, full on the lips. Geryon blushed and lowered his head in embarrassment.
Tell me,
Sinedra said, toying with the sleeve of his tunic.
Was Queen Salmisera as beautiful as they say?
She was the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life, Geryon answered without thinking. The princess caught her breath sharply.
I hate you,
she cried from between clenched teeth. Then she turned and ran sobbing in search of Aunt Paul. Geryon stared after her in perplexity. He turned then to stare moodily out at the river and the drifting ash. The tingling in his palm was becoming intolerable, and he scratched at it, digging it with his fingernails.
You'll just make it sore,
the voice in his mind said.
It itches. I can't stand it.
Stop being a baby.
But what's causing it? Do you mean to say you really don't know? Well, you've got further to go than I thought. Put your right hand on the amulet.
Why?
Just do it, Geryon.
Geryon reached inside his tunic and put his burning palm on his medallion. As a key fitting into the lock for which it was made, the contact between his hand and the throbbing amulet seemed somehow enormously right. The tingling became that now familiar surge, and the throbbing began to echo hollowly in his ears.
Not too much, the voice warned him. You're not trying to dry up the river, you know.
What's happening? What is all of this?
Belgarath's trying to find us.
Grandfather? Where?
Be patient.
The throbbing seemed to grow louder, until Geryon's entire body quivered with each thudding beat. He stared out over the rail, trying to see through the haze. The settling ash, so light that it coated the muddy surface of the river, made everything more than 20 paces away indistinct. It was impossible to see the city, and the wails and cries from the hidden streets seemed somehow muffled. Only the slow wash of the current against the hull seemed clear. Then, a long way out on the river, something moved. It was not very large, and seemed to be little more than a dark shadow, ghosting silently with the current. The throbbing grew even louder. The shadow drew closer, and Geryon could just begin to make out the shape of a small boat. An oar caught the surface of the water with a small splash. The man at the oars turned to look over his shoulder. It was Silk. His face was covered with gray ash, and tiny rivulets of sweat streaked his cheeks. Mr. Wolf sat in the stern of the little boat, muffled in his cloak, and with his hood turned up.
"Welcome back, Belgarath,"
the dry voice said.
"Who's that?" Wolf's voice in Geryon's mind sounded startled. "Is that you, Belgarion?"
"Not quite," the voice replied. "Not yet, anyway. But we are getting closer."
"I wondered who was making all that noise."
He overdoes things sometimes. He will learn eventually.
A shout came from one of the sailors clustered around Barak at the stern, and they all turned to watch the small boat drifting toward them. Aunt Paul came up from below and stepped to the rail.
"You're late,"
she called.
"Something came up,"
the old man answered across the narrowing gap. He pushed back his hood and shook the flowery ash out of his cloak. Then Geryon saw that the old man's left arm was bound up in a dirty sling across the front of his body.
"What happened to your arm?"
Aunt Paul asked.
"I'd rather not talk about it."
There was an ugly scratch running down one of Wolf's cheeks into his short white beard, and his eyes seemed to glitter with some huge irritation. The grin on Silk's ash-coated face was malicious as he dipped his oars once, deftly pulling the little boat in beside Greldick's ship, with a slight thump.
"I don't imagine you can be persuaded to keep your mouth shut,"
Wolf said irritably to the small man.
"Would I say anything, mighty sorcerer?"
Silk asked mockingly, his ferret eyes wide with feigned innocence.
"Just help me aboard,"
Wolf told him, his voice testy. His entire bearing was that of a man who had been mortally insulted.
"Yes. Whatever you say, ancient Belgarath,"
Silk said, obviously trying to keep from laughing. He steadied Wolf as the old man awkwardly climbed over the ship's rail.
"Let's get out of here,"
Mr. Wolf curtly told Captain Greldick, who had just joined them.
"Which way, ancient one?"
Greldick asked carefully, clearly not wanting to aggravate the old man further. Wolf stared hard at him.
"Upstream or down?" Greldick explained, mollifyingly. "Upstream, of course,"
Wolf snapped.
"How was I supposed to know?"
Greldick appealed to Aunt Paul. Then he turned and crossly began barking orders to his sailors. Aunt Paul's expression was a peculiar mixture of relief and curiosity.
"I'm sure your story's going to be absolutely fascinating, Father,"
she said, as the sailors began raising the heavy anchors.
"I simply can't wait to hear it."
"I can do without the sarcasm, Paul. I've had a very bad day. Try not to make it any worse."
That last was finally too much for Silk. The little man, in the act of climbing across the rail, suddenly collapsed in a helpless glee. He tumbled forward to the deck, howling with laughter. Mr. Wolf glared at his laughing companion with a profoundly affronted expression as Growlithe's sailors ran out their oars and began turning the ship in the sluggish current.
"What happened to your arm, father?"
Aunt Paul's gaze was penetrating, and her tone said quite clearly that she did not intend to be put off any longer.
"I broke it," Wolf told her flatly.
"How did you manage that?"
"It was just a stupid accident, Paul. Those things happen sometimes."
"Let me see it."
"In a minute."
He scowled at Silk, who was still laughing.
"Will you stop that? Go tell the sailors where we are going."
"And where are we going, father?"
Aunt Paul asked him.
"Did you find Zadar's trail?"
"He crossed into Trollmurgos. Tukchik was waiting for him."
"And the orb?"
"Tukchik's got it now."
"Are we going to be able to cut him off before he gets to Rakdol with it?"
"I doubt it. Anyway, we have to go to the Vale first."
"The Vale, father? But you're not making any sense."
"Our master has summoned us, Paul. He wants us at the Vale, so that's where we are going."
"What about the orb?"
"Krutik's got it. And I know where to find Krutik. He's not going any place. For right now, we're going to the Vale."
"All right, father," she concurred placatingly. "Don't excite yourself."
She looked at him closely.
"Have you been fighting, father?"
she asked dangerously.
"No, I haven't been fighting."
He sounded disgusted.
"Well, what happened then?"
"A tree fell on me."
"What?"
"You heard me."
Silk exploded into fresh howls of mirth at the old man's grudging confession. From the stern of the ship, where Growlithe and Barak stood at the tiller, the slow beat of the drum began, and the sailors dug in with their oars. The ship slid through the oily water, moving upstream against the current, with Silk's laughter trailing behind in the ash-laden air. Here ends Book 2 of the Belgariad. Book 3, Magician's Gambit, carries the quest on to the orb through stranger lands and darker magic, while Garion begins to learn the incredible power of the dry voice within his mind. This novel is a work of fiction. The names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or have been used fictitiously. From Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Cameron Byerly. Thanks for listening.